the Muay Thai Bones.
Library Coffee Edition.
We're calling this Library Coffee tentatively, okay?
Name pending.
Name pending. The idea of what we're doing now is not a regular Muay Thai Bones episode, but we're bringing the Muay Thai Bones concept to our Muay Thai Library sessions so that we can create iTunes podcast audios for the Muay Thai Library sessions as we film them, right?
Yes.
And a lot of people are telling us they love listening to Muay Thai Bones podcasts on iTunes. You can only do that as a patron supporter, but only $1 a month pledge gets you the podcast, and it also gets you, like, some of the, well, no, the best, Muay Thai content. Every month we put up about two hours of commentary documenting the Muay Thai Library legends and crews. I feel like I'm talking over you.
You're not talking over me, you're just giving the rundown.
Yeah, jump in there, baby.
So this is different from our regular Muay Thai Bones in that it is a direct extension of the library, in that I just voiced the Net Sak Narong library session fresh, and now we're going to talk about it like, hey, I just read this book in the library.
Totally.
Let's talk about
And so
Plato.
We got our coffees.
Kevin's not allowed to have iced coffee when we record because he chooses ice, so Kevin has to have hot coffee.
Have to have hot coffee. But actually enjoy hot coffee. And coffee is a major pleasure for us in our lives because we're keto. We call it keto 1+1. We fast every other day. So coffee, either with heavy cream on our eat days or just plain coffee, is like the big flavor input of our lives.
Coffee.
So going to go get a coffee. The idea is that we're going to take the Muay Thai Bones. Sorry to get a big introduction on this. We're going to get a Muay Thai Bones approach to the library, which means we want to talk about deep, big concepts. You won't even have to watch the library session to get something out of this. It'll be up on YouTube, but then this will also be part of the audio podcast. So on Patreon, you'll get this audio conversation and the audio of the Muay Thai Library. A lot of people told us, we put up a couple audios on SoundCloud a while ago, and they were like, I love listening to these sessions on the way to the gym, like to get psyched for the gym, which is really cool.
Yep.
You get the audio of the session, you can't see it, but in the magic of radio, you can kind of feel like you are in Thailand, and in this case, training with one of the great fighters of the 1970s, Sak Narong.
And literally, as we're doing this, we're down near Beach Road. You can hear Thailand happening around you right
now. Totally. And so part of what we want to do is we want to transport you to Thailand. We don't usually spend much time, if at all, much time at all, down by the beach here.
No.
It's kind of on the tourist side. But the energy is good, and it's always nice to be by the water.
Yeah.
So what we're trying to do here is we're trying to, like, we just watched, and we're going to do this right after filming sessions too, like when we go film somebody, then we'll go get a coffee and talk about it. But we want to, like, extract out the big principles and the big ideas that apply across the board to advanced students, beginning students. It's about the love of some guy walking by talking to somebody on the phone. We live in a weird technical age. We're, like, at a coffee shop shooting a podcast. I don't know. I just got struck by, like, I'm in the future.
The future is now.
I am in the future.
We just watched the Elton John movie, and we were like, what decade is this? We're trying to, like, find little hints for, like,
what
song it was or the clothes or things like that. And it's totally, that's going to be, like,
20 years from now, we're going to be watching this and be like, what
decade?
We'll be like, is this
Jesus, was that a Bluetooth? How old is that thing?
Okay, so this is unscripted, just freestyle conversation. We haven't even really discussed it between ourselves, so we might be like, you're totally wrong.
No.
And what? I guess, again, a little more intro. I want out of this to give you, like, the framework so that when you look at the session, patrons look at the session, they can just extract even more out of it.
Yeah, this was an interesting thing for me about voicing this one in particular, is that when we went to train with Net here in Pattaya, there was a long part in the beginning that's just warm-up.
Yeah, and which isn't usual for our sessions. Usually we get in there very fast.
No, but occasionally when you go and you tell someone you want a private session, they go into their, like, personal training private session mode, which involves this whole, like, you know, warm-up, change to this thing, whatever, and it's very routine. And for a very long time, this is something that I'm like, let's just get past this or let's skip this altogether or whatever the thing is. Net is 64 years old. He's in amazing shape, but...
Yeah, he's one of those,
you don't
like, Jack
like,
O'Lane types.
You don't want to be like, let's push you really hard. The thing about putting it in context and what you're saying about, like, we want you guys to have context so that while you're looking at it, I just want you to see things.
I don't know where you're going here,
I'm getting there. I want you to see things that I see, is that instead of like, oh, what a boring 15-minute calisthenics workout, when I was watching it and when I was experiencing it, I put it into this context that's like, what is he warming up? Like, what are the parts of the body that are important to warm up? What is this thing that he's been living in France for 30 years that have changed for him, teaching French students for 30 years, but being a legend of the golden age? Like,
oh, yeah, I agree with you.
To me, this is interesting, putting it in the context of, like...
But we say this in the podcast.
Yeah, we also say it here because this is an extension of the podcast.
Okay. I just don't want to repeat. I don't want people to get to the session and then hear the same points we just made.
No, yeah, I was giving an example of how putting things in context allow you to see them differently than, let me fast forward, I already know how to throw a kick, is what is he showing you about the kick?
I also want to say these warm-ups almost only occur with Thais that train Westerners or foreigners. Like we almost...
I think you could take the almost out of that.
Sing Dom, who trains a lot of people at Yokao. Yep. Kru Noi, who's here in Pattaya, trained a lot of people
in Singapore.
Not Westerners, but non-Thais. And there's only a few. So this was an unusual session. So if you're listening to this on the audio, there's going to be 10 minutes or so of warm-up that Sylvie's going to be talking about. But we want to expand this out to bigger ideas. One of the first things... I took a note on that, just to set the frame, is that you called this Arjun Net a golden age fighter. To me, he's not anywhere near the golden age. He is, to me, what I would call the silver age, which were these fighters, and even Diesel Noi is a little bit crossover.
It's like on the cusp.
He's on the cusp of the golden age, and then as he fought and had the big match against Sumart, who's a classic golden age fighter, he definitely was golden age, but this is really the late 70s, mid 70s, early 70s, like Siriman Khan, which is so unbelievably special. Like, yes, we want to capture contemporary Muay Thai knowledge, golden age knowledge for sure, because it was the peak of the sport. But when we get a chance to just like film and talk to the generation before Diesel Noi, like, it feels very rare, and that's... It makes my heart pump. Because once these people stop teaching, he's 64 years old, he's in fantastic shape, but many people can't teach, really, in that era. And so it's really special to even record this.
Yeah.
Like, he was fighting... He talked about fighting Po Tsai, right? Isn't that his name?
Po Tsai.
Who everyone says was like Diesel Noi, but before Diesel Noi. So Diesel Noi had not come, but he was a tall, horrible knee fighter.
Yeah.
Horrible in the best possible
terrifying
sense. Right.
Yeah.
Put him in the hospital. He said he went to the hospital afterwards.
Yeah.
So this is before the golden age, which is just as a scene setter, to be able to document the silver age is pretty cool to me.
Yes.
And how did it feel to move around with a silver age fighter?
I didn't think about it like that, honestly. The thing that was interesting to me is that many times that I've worked with and met these older Thai men, they're like time capsules.
Yeah.
Like Master K is like that. Diesel Noi is a little bit like that. Net is like that. They just kind of like, it's like if you
they keep their world with them across
the decades. It's like if you
decades.
Met an older Southern gentleman who had like an old Southern gentleman thing about him that you're like, men aren't like that anymore.
Yeah.
It's not necessarily his quality of a man, but there are elements of his style and his movement that you're like, that's older. Like, that feels older.
And you brought up this idea in your commentary is also because he's been teaching in France for 30-plus years.
Like, my lifetime.
Yeah, which is so incredible. And he probably was very instrumental in the history of Yod Moy Muay Thai in France. Yeah. France is known as probably the best Furong fighters in the world. They have the most belt championships, like Lumpini champions. That there was an infusion of Yod Moy, like elite level Muay Thai, into France very early on, and it somehow combined with their love of savate and boxing. And he has that gentlemanly French quality about him, which is really cool to see this kind of intersectional history of Muay Thai in one man. Mm. And then Krong Sok, the next generation, came over to France too. So there's like a lineage there, and Krong Sok is in the Muay Thai library.
Yeah.
And you might want to watch those two sessions
and,
together.
And Phut Pat Noi, who I really want to get for the library, who's Silver Age. He's older than Net. He's 70 now, I think, already.
Mm.
He was in France for like 20 years.
Yeah, I think he was the very first Yod Moy to come over there.
Yeah.
So this is a lineage, a little line of French Muay Thai, which is really world Muay Thai, and in the end of it is like the propagation of the highest form of the art.
Yeah.
And then it folds back into Thailand and in the library. It's very cool.
Mm.
Do you have anything you wanted to start with, like a big idea that you took from this? The most powerful idea in me, it was you kept mentioning it in the audio commentary, is footwork, having your foot close.
Oh, man.
Foot close.
I obsess about these small things, and it's not because I'm a nerd, it's because they're important, which, I don't know, maybe if you talk to a nerd, they'd say exactly the same thing.
Gear Wars.
How much do you know about the Gear Wars? but the... There's something amiss to this idea that you like go and collect weapons from certain people. Like, I want to get Diesel Noy's knee and Yodkun Pan's elbow, as if it's like a adventure video game D&D where you're like collecting weapons, or like you have to like stockpile this to get to the next thing. It's not like that, because each of those techniques and what's amazing about them is not able to be isolated from the person who's using it. Like, the reason Yodkun Pan's elbows are the way that they are is because of how he fought. That's talking about isolating something.
So, well, can I do a little detour? I just want to say, for the people that use the library, one way you can use it is to steal techniques.
Yes.
Like, go get Yodkun Pan's elbow, go get Diesel Noy's knee, go get a Poinsenet's low kick, right? You can do it that way, but what you're saying is that one reason why we do these sessions hour long is it's part of an entire fighting style and philosophy. And that if you really want to use that weapon the way that Yodkun Pan does, you have to understand so much more that surrounds it. Yeah, you can try to like clip it out and add it to your D&D collection, right?
Yeah.
But you're saying, in order to really use it the way that you're looking at it, you have to grab more of the fighter, maybe. Am I following you right on that?
I think that's what's incredible about learning it from that person rather than, like, snipping it out.
Yes.
But why I focus on a detail, like, to me, one of the most amazing things about the session with Net is the way that he kept emphasizing where my foot landed near his foot.
Yeah.
That's not a technique per se.
Right.
But it's so important to how everything else grows around it. It's the seed around all these other things. It's like, stand here kind of thing. And it's like how the Amazon warriors cut off their breasts so that they could do the bow. Mm. You're like, I'm going to learn to fire a bow really good.
Mythological.
You're like, I'm going to learn to fire a bow really good.
Yeah.
Right? There's a whole body map deformity that goes with that. And I don't mean deformity in a, like, mutant bad way. I mean it in a, like, focusing on this one thing is what everything else hangs on.
Well, maybe we should say that what a lot of part of this was, he's a Southpaw fighter. You moved to Southpaw for the session in order so that his style could map onto yours more easily, right? Mm-hmm. And a large part of what you became aware of in your voiceover is where your right lead foot is stepping.
On an orthodox fighter.
On an orthodox fighter.
Yeah.
And what you needed was to step close.
Yeah, but it was...
And also the angle of your toe, right?
Yeah. But it's... I think the first time I realized this was in a Yod Kun Pan. My first Yod Kun Pan session was that millimeters make such a big difference. Mm. Is that when I was watching my foot in this session, it was like, okay, I'm stepping here.
Right.
No, it's here. Like, it's on it kind of thing. Like, these millimeters make such a difference for what your overall balance and distance is.
Right.
And that's not something that if you watched a 5-minute highlight clip or if you watched it out of context.
Or edits or anything. Okay. I thought about this too while watching your commentary. I feel like getting that foot close... And it's also something you need to do from orthodox. Getting that, but it's more important in mixed stance. Getting that foot close and outside is very, very hard to do. Like, you've known this for years now, right?
Yes.
For people watching and listening, I feel like this, like, millimeters make a difference. I don't know. I feel like this is extraordinarily hard. Just conceptually understanding it doesn't do anything for you. If you're like, my foot should be closer, you've known that for a very long time. Right?
In the inner game of tennis, the author talks about how technical corrections just in isolation don't make sense. If you're like, you need to loosen up your grip. Loosening up your grip is... comparative.
On a
like
tennis racket,
to what? Yeah. Like, how tight are you? Like, maybe you actually don't need to loosen up your grip, and then someone says loosen up your grip and you loosen it more and it makes it worse. Like, loosen compared to what? So track the foot, stand close to the foot is like close compared to what? Like, it's...
But I feel like part of the problem is we think in the West in terms of positions. Like, technically, what angle should I do this at? Where should I put my foot on the ground? Like, we treat the body like a mannequin where you want to put everything where it's supposed to be.
Right. Like, and if you put a piece of tape on the ground, every person could step on that tape and it would be accurate or something.
Yeah, but the problem is when you think like that, it tends not to actually lead you to being able to do that.
Because it stops you from feeling.
Yes, yeah. I feel like...
You target instead
that
of feeling.
Exactly. And I feel like this is something everyone suffers from to some degree, especially when you don't learn when you're very young, right?
Yeah.
In the Thai way of feel, 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 play, play, play. So how does one overcome that? Because it's been a weakness for you, too, getting that lead foot close. You know it's supposed to be close. But knowing it actually doesn't help you, and it might even make it worse. Because then you're like, damn, I'm not stepping. Like, how many years have you been saying that about your right kick?
But that was the thing.
I'm not stepping.
Even in that session, I knew I was supposed to be close to his foot, but then when I was watching it for the voiceover, I'm like, I'm nowhere near his foot. Like, I thought I was stepping near his foot, and I wasn't.
Okay, but that's the... Where's the...
Because I wasn't feeling it. Like, if I had felt stepping here allows this, if I had felt that, I would have known I was miles away from this foot.
Okay, so how do you not target? I guess what I'm leading to, you just were reminded of this lesson now, today.
Uh-huh.
Like, a few hours ago you voiced it. Uh-huh. You're going to go back to the gym. You're going to be telling yourself to step close. How do you feel it instead of target it? I mean, it's not something you can answer right now, but this is a big concept for people, right?
It's because by turning it into a verbal demand,
right,
step close to the foot, has no feeling of proximity. Whereas when I actually stepped right next to his foot and threw the elbow and I'm like, holy shit, I'm like crowding. It's actually that feeling of proximity that's uncomfortable that keeps me from actually stepping there. And so it becomes the, like, verbal step there rather than become uncomfortable, become uncomfortable, yeah, become uncomfortable, or, like, crash yeah through him, crash through
I
him.
I think,
like,
that is the get comfortable being uncomfortable. Again, we return to that theme. We've talked about it, right?
Yeah, which goes back to the me working on eye contact, which was also something that Net, in his Frenchness and his Thai-ness, was like, eye contact is that it's not just look in the eyes, it's the discomfort and connection. It's that synergy feels like something is what keeps me from doing it.
So
you have to get back into it.
I actually, when watching this again, had connected these two ideas, mm-hmm, which is one of the tendencies if you don't make eye contact is to look at, to target with your eyes.
Right.
Especially with an uncomfortable pad holder. Like, you don't know your pad holder. He's calling for something. You're like, where's the mitt going to come up? What am I supposed to do? Am I supposed to throw the hook? Am I supposed to throw the elbow? All these verbal commands and eye targeting is, when you contact, when you look in the eyes and you commit to that, it's a psychological connection.
Yeah.
And it prevents you from being able to eye target positions either on the floor or where you want to hit.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of noticed in that session that you would do eye contact, but then right at the last second when you're supposed to hit the mitt, you would look at the mitt.
Mm-hmm.
Because you don't want to miss it.
Yep.
And I think that this is about surrendering to the possibility that you could miss and it's okay.
Mm.
And the moving away from perfectionism, maybe.
Mm.
When you, if you're like, I need to step on the foot, but I'm not going to look at the foot to see where I'm stepping. But you're like, I'm going to look in the eyes and I'm going to step right at your foot. The two together produces feeling.
Right, which is why I feel like there's a galaxy of difference between learning anything from a fighter of that caliber and experience versus learning that technique from the, like,
someone who knows it
game of telephone down, like, I got this and this is where you step. Like, yeah, I know you step there.
Yeah.
But when I step there, I don't feel that holy shit get away from me that you feel when a fighter of that caliber is that close to you.
There was a very cool moment in the session where he's teaching you a teep and a clock kick and a throwaway. And you're like, I'm trying to do the technical thing. And he's like, no, you have to, like, throw it away like a French
gentleman. I talked about that in my
gentleman
voiceover.
Yeah. But I'm saying this was brought up in the session, too. This, like, when you're watching these legends, right, in the Muay Thai library, and a whole hour, you're not just looking for positions or technical things you can steal. But in that whole hour, you see all their body language,
yeah,
all their psychology, all their energy.
Yeah, it's why you can go watch a middle school performance of Hamlet and see some kid go, words, 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 and it means nothing.
Yeah.
Versus you go and you watch, I don't know, like Kenneth Branagh on Broadway or something doing it, and the way that he says exactly the same thing actually infuses meaning into what those script words are.
And so when you're learning a technique, any technique, you want to find how does one really say that line?
Yeah.
Not just how do you say it. It's not to be or not to be.
I said I love you. What's the problem? I love you.
And you get that in things like Diesel Noy's knees.
Like Diesel Noy's anything.
You have to have the whole affect of I'm going to shred you and kill you. Or Kara Hott's step back, rubber band movements. When you're watching these sessions, you want to, like, steal all the music.
Yeah.
Not just the little lyric, the hook of the song.
The phrasing.
Yeah, right? Yeah. And I feel like that's a clue to how to bring your Muay Thai to the next level. There's a really, he's no longer with the gym, but Pody at the gym, a little Thai kid, little pudgy Thai kid.
A little butterball.
When we first came to Phetchum Rung, and it was probably in our first week or two. I remember, I don't know if you have the same memory, but he was on the bag, and Filippo came by and was like, this is Pody. And Pody was like impersonating in his face guys he'd seen on in video.
I think he was being Bukow or something.
Probably not Bukow. Guys don't watch Bukow. So.
I don't know, some YouTube thing that he'd seen.
It was a fighter. He was doing somebody's face. And it was cool that as a kid he was impersonating and embodying not a technique, but Mean Mug, like this whole persona he was taking on. And he was like, what, 8 years old or something?
Yeah. And not super skilled. But that was something that Joe Hong Tong said, that, again, there are things that you can learn during library sessions that are not technique or even movements. It's these men who, being who they are expressing something, talking, they're expressing something. He was talking about how you used to have to, like, watch the highlights of fights on TV. There were no reruns. There was no YouTube. Like, you had to catch that fight when
he's
it was on.
He's saying as a Thai fighter when he was growing up.
He's after the Golden Age. He's young. So he was watching all of the Golden Age fighters when he was a fighter coming up. And he was like, you'd watch it, and then you would go to training, and you'd be like, okay, you be Long Suan, and I'm going to be Lam Namoon, and we're going to do this thing.
He trained with his brother, Jen. So it was Jen and Joe, the twins.
Right, but the point being that they learned by imitating. Like, what Pody's doing is old school. Like, Pody's version has YouTube, where you can, like, watch the same fight 10 times.
That's actually one of the cool things that MMA Shredded does when he's like, I'm going to fight like Sanchai or whatever.
Oh, and his sparring?
Yeah, and his sparring.
So
like, he brings it to sparring, and there is a degree of that. He's not just training techniques. He's like, you have to get the rhythm of the whole thing and get that energy.
And I've had that where, like, I am fucking up the technique over and over and over again, and then I'm like, oh, wait, be Karahat. And I, like, wear his attitude, and it works.
There's a little piece of this getting the foot close, which is interesting, which is the bounce out, which is also in the session, where after you complete a elbow or something,
step back.
Little step back. And we all train, you train it on the bag, and everyone does this, right?
Yeah.
But there's also something about Western bodily sensibilities where the bounce out is a very natural kind of like protection instinct. Mm. And then with the bounce out is the ass back. Like when you feel fear, you like pop your ass back a little bit. It's almost like the protecting the groin, because the groin is this, I don't know, there's something Western about putting the ass back that's not Thai.
Yep.
Thai is put the hips in or neutral. They will pop the ass back in order to create differential, but the West, they want to hunch over the Greco-Roman wrestlers hunched over, the boxers hunched over, but this ass back pop out thing is the enemy of getting your foot close and being close.
Yeah.
And how do you train that? Like, what's your advice? Because it's something you struggle with yourself. Like, all these years, you still have some of these body mappings. You can't just scold yourself. Well, you can.
No, that
you
doesn't,
can. You can.
Work.
It doesn't change anything. It just makes you feel shitty about your technique.
I've complained about being fat so many times. I haven't not lost weight.
That's a very good analogy, actually. How many times have you yelled at yourself about that, right?
It's getting used to that discomfort. It's a cliche. It's get comfortable being uncomfortable kind of thing. But as you find where that millimeter is, or you find where that position is that's uncomfortable, like standing next to somebody when they're talking to you, like, this is comfortable, this isn't, stand here.
Mm. You mean in real life?
In real life.
Yeah. Get used to taking space a little bit?
Yeah, or like, I have this problem, and then Shay, who's been training at our gym, he's a big dude. Shay is the opposite of me in terms of just size. He's enormous, like a Great Dane. And he also is really shy about touching the trainer's head. You're supposed to, like, grab the trainer's head and, like, knee the shit out of them.
He's also a very polite, sweet guy, like, one of the nicest guys you'll meet.
Totally.
So that's part of it.
Totally.
It's like, how do you do that?
It's like, I don't want to touch this thing because it's uncomfortable, and I don't want to be impolite.
Yeah.
And it's like, the impolite part is a attitude more than it is actually touching. Like we.
Well, you have this too, though. For the longest time, you would not. You would barely touch the head.
I still, yeah. At times, like, can't do it.
Yeah.
But it's one of these things that, like, when you're coming to Thailand, you read in a book, don't point your feet at things.
Mm.
Don't touch anyone's head. You know, all these things that, again, when you have the context, you see people breaking these rules all the time. And it's an attitude thing. Like, obviously don't point your feet at the Buddha or at someone's grandfather, but if you're sitting in such a way and your feet are, like, pointing at somebody, nobody
cares
that much.
I've thought that to myself, like, I'm crossing my legs in a certain way on the ground. I'm like, who am I blasting with the bottom of my feet? Like, which way is this going, and is it not appropriate in some way? Like, yesterday we were at the temple, and I was like...
I see people moving stuff with their feet all the time, which they say don't do. Right?
Yeah.
And it's context. It's like, yeah, that's impolite, but you're in your house in a gym.
Just,
like,
it's not just context. It's also when you're at a Thai gym, it'd be like if you were learning manners, you wouldn't learn it in a
boxing club?
Boxing gym in the Bronx.
In a bar.
Like, there's also social class and things. So I think there's something for being polite, but I don't want to get too sidetracked on this polite thing. It's more like Westerners need to learn often how to take up space physically.
But my point being, abstractly in the world, I don't want to be impolite touching someone's head, right?
Right.
I'm not going to go around touching everyone's head in order to get used to touching my trainer's head. But in that context, it's my feeling about touching the head that's making me uncomfortable, not literally
I disagree because you won't grab the shoulder either. I don't think it's a...
That's because I don't want to be close to people.
That's what it's really about.
So I have to train being close.
Yes.
It's not don't touch here, don't touch there.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's what's uncomfortable, do that.
Yeah, and you have to be incremental and forgiving of yourself. Like, honestly, what you learned with Yokumpon is millimeters make a difference.
Yeah.
And that if you can move your whole presence on balance in your stance into the space and be relaxed just a little bit, that's a huge victory, and it can have a huge psychological impact over the course of a fight.
Yeah.
Like, if you're fighting somebody and they're 1 inch, 2 inches closer on almost all movements, it has this wearing effect.
That's why PNU is so exhausting. Like, people come and do pads, and they'll do pads with one trainer, and they're like, my cardio is great. And then they do pads with PNU, and they're like, oh, my God, I don't know why I'm so tired. And I'm like, it's not you.
Yeah.
It's PNU, and it's because of the distance he stands at, people don't even realize they're not breathing.
Yeah. He takes
the
breath away.
They don't
know. And then why am I gassed after fucking half a round?
It's like if you didn't understand altitude and you're like, why am I dying?
It is
like you're in Estes Park.
It is a form of altitude. And when you train in Thailand, it's like training in psychological altitude.
Yeah.
So I think we did good on our first library coffee, are we calling this?
Library coffee.
Okay.
Name pending.
If you're listening to this on iTunes, on podcast already, what's following this is going to be the audio of the Sok Narong session with Sylvie's commentary. Why are you cracking up?
I find it very funny that you call him by his gym name, which is much harder than his fight name, which is just Net.
Like, because his fight name has been Nate. It's been said Nate. It's spelled Netter with an R.
That's because it's how it's spelled.
But there's too many variables in his Nate fight. So.
Okay.
And I also like the name of Sok Narong.
It's nice.
It's a pretty name.
Yeah.
It feels like old school.
It does.
Right?
feels a little fisticuffy.
And if you're watching this on YouTube, you can get the audio version of it by becoming a patron. The link will be in the description. And thank you to everyone who already is a patron in making our Muay Thai library grow. And, like, honestly, oh, baby, grab this, please.
Thank you.
Slight interruption, but helping our Muay Thai library grow. Go ahead, help me.
I'm distracted. I was just moving the thing, so I don't know what you're saying.
Okay.
Thank you, patrons, for helping our library grow, and everything that I do is through patrons. So.
Thank you to our sponsors. We have Smack Gym in Australia, Chikara Martial Arts in Australia, Jae-Soo and family. We was an individual person who just wanted to support the library as a sponsor. He's been very generous with us. Zesty Kicks.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Very active on Instagram.
And an anonymous, somebody who is an anonymous sponsor as well.
Anonymous.
If you want to become a sponsor, just message Sylvie. It helps everything stay together, and you're part of the Muay Thai Library family. So,
building a library.
Building a library. Okay, signing off.
This is driving through Pattaya on the way to see Ajahn Net Saknarong. He was a fighter kind of just prior to the Golden Age, like the very early Golden Age, peaking in the 70s, like 75 through 77. And he was in Pattaya at this gym that's way out on like the edge of Pattaya that Kevin and I had been to before because we had gone to see Krongsak over there and train with him. He was from the Golden Age. He fought Diesel Noi, but he's young in the Golden Age. And the interesting thing about going to see Ajahn Net at the same gym where we had seen Krongsak is that it completely makes sense. They both relocated to become trainers in France. And when we talked to Krongsak, we were asking him about the fighters that he used to look up to, and we showed him the 123 All-Time Great Fighters of Thailand book. And when he came to Net's page, he got this look on his face, and he's like, "This is my idol, this is my hero." And I had never really heard of Net before, partly because of his age, partly because even though he was ranked number one at Lumpini and Rajadamnern for a very long time, he never won a belt. He is in the book of 123 all-time greatest fighters, but Muay Thai in Thailand is still very largely an oral history. There are things written, there are archives now and documentation, which is great, but hearing from fighters who they looked up to, who they idolized, who they wanted to fight, or who they wanted to fight like, is still a huge part of what Muay Thai in Thailand is. You ask Diesel Noi who the greatest fighter was, and he'll just talk about Wichin Noi all day. And Ajahn Net fought Wichin Noi. So knowing who these great fighters looked up to and who they idolized, and then hearing about how this person fought that person, or this person beat that person or lost to, but it was a great fight, this is how you kind of track parts of Muay Thai that still are not largely written. This is the Warrior Gym in Pattaya. I've been to it several times because we've trained with Krongsak and now Net here, and yet I still drive by it by accident when I'm trying to find it, because it's just on this road on the edge of Pattaya leading down to the beach. And it's a huge, beautiful gym. Ajahn Net has been in France for like 30-something years. This is him. The reason I knew he was in Pattaya is because I saw a Muay Siam reporter took a photo with him and posted on Facebook, and I was like, I know that gym. I didn't know what Net looked like. He's in his 60s, and he doesn't speak English a lot. Kevin thinks his English is quite good, but he speaks French fluently, obviously, having been in France for so long, and I'm speaking to him in Thai. So he was just in Pattaya, kind of taking care of the gym while the owner of the gym was traveling. The owner of the gym is French. But this is the incredible thing about the Muay Thai library, is that you find these fighters who have had incredible impact on Muay Thai kind of anywhere. So, as I said, Ajahn Net is in his 60s. And he still moves really great. He brought me into the ring to do like these calisthenics, which I don't love doing like elaborate warm-up routines when I come to learn the techniques of fighters. If you watch my session with Sing Dam,
He had a very long warm-up routine because he's used to giving private lessons to people who are maybe not fighters or beginners. But I've come to appreciate this part of the training session, even though it's basically developed out of these ex-fighters training Westerners. The reason I find it interesting now is seeing what they warm up. If you have a trainer who's spending a lot of time on the hips, you know that they're going to kick a lot. Watching Ajahn Nett when I was doing that arm exercise just now that he was having me do to stretch out the shoulders, I have very tight shoulders, and the way that, for example, Yod Kun Pan focuses on warming up the shoulders, you can understand why that's so necessary for his style. And some of it is honestly just the years and years of experience, decades of training outside of Thailand, of training Westerners. This part, we're just reaching down and touching our toes, kind of, and I'm super inflexible, but looking at Ajahn Nett's body, looking at the extension of his hamstrings and what his body is like, what his flexibility is like, to me this is very interesting to see in active fighters and former fighters, like what their body is accustomed to. You can see that in things that otherwise might be invisible.
Okay.
He sees how inflexible I am and he's trying to help me. This kind of stretch here, I don't think this was anything he did when he was a fighter in Thailand. I think that this is entirely constructed out of his 30 years of training people in Normandy and France. He has his own gym now. But this part here, this is something that you do in the Ram Muay. So it's something that I recognize from my track and field days in PE class, but the way that he moves into and out of some of these positions completely looks like the Ram Muay. So there's this like integration of old and foreign and all of these different things that come into play with it. He had this interesting symmetry, the way that he like touches his leg and then reaches towards his toe. So there's this like flexing and unflexing part that also reminded me of the Ram Muay. There's a lot of like bouncing and rocking in the Ram Muay that kind of pulsing. I do remember from like my PE classes when I was young to like count to 30 doing this or something. But having the movement in it, because I'm familiar with a Ram Muay as a way to prepare yourself for the fight, I actually got more into it than I think I ever have before. I hate stretching so much. But this thing that he's doing here, I actually really dig. And look at how kind of gentle he is in this process, as like this is just part of the mundane preparation for anything that he's going to teach me. He was one of these fighters who went to America in the 70s and fought against kickboxers. He had a fight against Ernest Hart and was able to KO him in round 5 in the U.S. in 1977. It must have been crazy to be a Thai fighter traveling all the way to California to have a fight in kickboxing, no less. Probably giving up a lot of weight. There's a generation of these fighters from the Golden Age who did have that opportunity to kind of travel and fight. It's something that's more common now. But even though it's so common now, it still carries this prestige to it. Thais are very proud when they get to fight outside of Thailand and represent Muay Thai for their country. And it's this kind of like internationalism that they get into. I thought it was cool that as part of his warm-up, he made me do sit-ups. And right here, he's telling me what Sagat tells me about sit-ups. He's like, don't come all the way up. It's completely useless. So instead, he just wants to isolate with the crunch so that you never actually relax your stomach muscles at any point. And he had us do 100 as part of the warm-up. Again, he's in his 60s, and he's banging out 100 sit-ups before we do any actual Muay Thai. I really like his style. Both he and Krongsak have this, like, French Thai charisma that comes from their decades of being trainers in France. Net was very well known for... He was a southpaw fighter, and he was very well known for having a huge left kick, a really good cross, and he said that he really liked his hook as well. That's a style that would work really well against pretty much any range of fighting. He fought the best during his time. He was never given the opportunity, I don't think, for the belt, which is something that happens sometimes. You'll have these incredibly good fighters who fight all the best fighters, but they just don't politically have the opportunity for the belt. So here we're doing the side abs, which I don't see a lot still in Thai gyms. I don't know if this is something that is imported from his time in France or not. It's not easy, though. He comes over to help me. It's part of his focus as this being a private session. It becomes a little bit like a personal training session at the same time in the way that he's assisting me. Sometimes when we do these library sessions and we talk to these legends and ex-fighters, they don't really know entirely what I want when I'm saying that I just want to learn their style. They see it as like this whole like personal training session, but once they start actually just moving, it's like when they take the structure out of it and just start moving in Muay Thai, it all comes back and they can't help but teach their style because it's an expression of who they are. But the way that Ajahn Net is assisting me here, I feel like is also very much an expression of who he is. He's had his own gym in Normandy for, I think he said 20 years, but they've just opened a new one. I don't know if it was a change of location. But when he goes back to France after this stint in Pattaya, he's going to be going back to his gym in Normandy. So if you're in France and want to go see Ajahn Net, that's where you go. This I also really, really liked. This is part of a warm-up, and he makes me strengthen my neck. As a clinch fighter, it's super important to have a strong neck. It's something that's very underappreciated, I think, in the way that clinch is trained outside of Thailand. He's just putting some pressure on my forehead so that I have resistance in trying to do basically like sit-ups with my neck. I have a strong neck. I do neck exercises and have for years, and this was hard. I like that you start the whole thing with that, though. Okay. Look at the muscles in his arms. It's like 64. There's a big emphasis on strength in every single person I've ever trained with. They talk about how important it is to have conditioning behind everything that you're doing. He told me this was Sanchai footwork. I was doing it wrong with my arms and my legs not being quite coordinated. But it's kind of like the Muhammad Ali shuffle step, but with like sprinter's arms at the same time. It's a little bit like a jumping jack or something in terms of a warm-up. But he explains to me that why you do that is because you want to be fast with your switch step. He's southpaw. He's standing orthodox because he doesn't know who I am. So I think he just automatically goes orthodox for his students a lot of times. He told me, because I stood in southpaw to learn from him, he told me that teaching me would be very easy because I was southpaw like him. So he's asking me if I need to wrap my hands, and I say I don't normally wrap them. But look at how he brings his hip and the way he turns his back leg on that punch. Even if you're just throwing into someone's hand, like there's no power on it. But the turn is the technique itself. And he's just feeling out punches and elbows. The way he starts out with punches and elbows, the way any trainer starts out with something, gives you a very strong indication of what their, like, emphasis is. So he wants me to jab and then throw the elbow. So you're taking two distances, right? So the jab is longer and then the elbow is as you've already stepped in. So the actual technique is in your feet. And if you watch my feet as I'm doing this, they're a little bit all over the place, and he immediately corrects my foot and tells me that I need to step right outside of his. See where his right foot just went? His front foot? Just to be able to cross through your target. See how far out my right foot was? I love that he makes this correction. It means he's so aware of it himself. I've noticed in my own training, by tracking my opponent's feet, all of my balance and distance comes into a greater focus. And it means that he's very aware of that in his own Muay Thai as well. He's saying if you step too far out, your elbow actually isn't going to reach. You've actually cut off some of your own distance, which is why he's telling me that on that last elbow, which is the closest range weapon that you throw, he wants the foot basically on top of, like right next to your opponent's foot. And then because I'm standing right next to him, when I throw that back knee, it's going to go through him. He's making a point here about how that reach across to his neck on the knee protects from any upper body strikes that he might be throwing as a defense. So he's having me throw teeps here, and really what he's starting with those punches, elbows, and teeps is feeling of distance. So he wants me to strike as I'm slowly closing that distance for the more powerful strikes of elbows and knees. It's like taking little bites as you get closer with each of these strikes to like eat that distance. Look at his hook. I can see why he said his hook was so good. Again, he points out where my foot should be. See how it's like basically matched up with his front foot? So if I end up stepping past his foot, I can throw the elbow because of the distance. But when I step outside his foot, I'm kind of angling my toes towards him, which makes me overturn. He keeps his toes pointed straight back when he steps to the outside of my foot and then turns with the hook after. I'm asking him whether he wants an angled elbow, and he says if you do the angled elbow, it's to cut down across someone's forehead to go through the guard. But what he wants is actually to cut across the nose with this. It's called fan sok in Thai. It goes like horizontally. It's basically a hook, but with your elbow. I love how he keeps me honest with those palms coming out and just kind of like hitting my elbows. Those make me remember that my guard has a purpose. Like, you don't just leave your arms up because that's where they're supposed to be. So he put a belly pad on, and then ultimately he decides against it. Like, just, I'm explaining to him here that what I want, everything is up to him. I just want to learn whatever his style and technique is. And when I explained this to him and he understood it, the first thing he says has to do with watching. He's like, his style is looking your opponent in the eyes and just punching into that, like, space of their vision. I love that he ended up taking the belly pad off. He's like, we're just going to feel this whole thing. So he's teaching me here how to dodge back to make the opponent's kick miss. But the important thing about the way that you dodge back is not actually losing distance. See how my front leg drags back just a little bit? His doesn't. When he does his lean back, it's only his back foot that goes. And he actually doesn't lean super far. Like, it's not like a matrix lean back. And it allows him to counter immediately after the kick has passed. So he's showing me that there's two options. One is to block it and kick back. The other one is to get out of the way and kick back. But ultimately, the distance between those two is mostly the same. I cannot stress enough, guys, with all of these lessons that are going into the Muay Thai library, the importance of never giving up ground and about space, like spacing and how close you are to your opponent. Watching a legend or a trainer or a fighter's feet and what distance they keep tells you so much about their style. He's showing me here how these different elbows go around the angles of someone's guard. So he's giving me a variety of elbows. He's giving me like three elbows. One is upward, and then on the same arm it goes around, and then you can lead into a knee. But the important part of those elbows and the angles that they're cutting are how close you are to your opponent when you're throwing them. See how every little millimeter he takes as he goes backwards in catching those strikes? I'm supposed to be eating that space right after him. It's like a wave filling in the hole that you're digging in sand. That's the guard he wants. See how it just comes up and the elbow's kind of forward? He tucks behind his shoulder like a boxer, but he keeps his guard actually quite long. He says that this guard, just there, he was saying that this guard actually is what sets up for the knee. So your opponent is striking up top and you're blocking it, and then you just submarine the knee underneath it. Because you know where their concentration is by feeling that they're hitting you up top. This was also a point that he kept coming back to with me, which was how you step outside your opponent after each of your strikes. I was running in a circle there showing how if you stay in one spot, your opponent can strike back, but if you keep going to the outside of their guard, they have to chase you. See how he has to keep pivoting to track me? That's what he's doing with his fingers. He's like, you're getting your opponent to basically follow you in a circle. That's why it's important to step outside of the foot on all of his strikes, is it allows you to then pivot out. Like, where you step on landing your strike is already setting up what your opportunity is after you've thrown the strike. He wanted me to flex my foot on the block. There are two schools of thought. There are people who make you point your toe because they say that you could hurt your toes on the kick. And then there are people who make you flex your foot because they say it flexes the muscle in your shin and basically makes the block stronger. He's of the school of thought where you flex your foot. It's a little bit older. So again, he's making this point that you have multiple options all the time. You can block with just your front leg, or you can block on either side. But no matter what you do, when you come down off of the block, you want to be throwing your counter. So it's actually the same strike off of either of those options. And then he wants me to teep to create that distance. So you stay there, and then I use my strikes to come in again. He's saying try to come in at me with punches. That's what the leg teep is for. It's brilliant. He's speaking Thai to me, and then when I do it correctly, he goes, voila. It's like totally. Totally bilingual right there. Look at the distance that he creates. He has me throw a three-punch combination, and then immediately the thing that he does as he's moving out for me to, like, throw the strike that he's asking for, I'm taking steps after each of my strikes. You can't stay in one spot. Here he's having me jab and kick the outside of the leg. But again, the point of this is to interrupt your opponent and pivot off to the side. Look at him look me in the eye. And then he wants me to either block or get out of the way. There's a very interesting thing to me that happens in... He was a femur fighter, which is the kind of technical, evasive, kind of fast fighters. The thing about a femur fighter from the Golden Age is that they did not take a lot of space. Like, they didn't stay far away from their opponents. They stayed right in. They just were constantly tagging and getting out of the way of the counters. I had a little bit of trouble with this uppercut, I think because I'm not naturally southpaw. I think I still have not figured out that side quite yet. But he was showing me how to bring the uppercut from your hip. I think my elbow was popping out a little bit, but he, when he throws it, he has this very beautiful transition of weight from his front leg. See how he kind of like pops his right knee up at the same time he throws his right uppercut, and then he brings his weight forward for the cross. I was telling him that I'm not standing well, like I feel like I'm wobbling. And so when he just threw that combination, the way he was kind of moving sideways was by keeping his front leg constantly stepping out to the right. So he's southpaw, and his right leg is constantly making these minimal steps out to the right that allow him to not have his shoulder fall outside of his own frame. Look how close. And again, he wants me to circle out off of everything. So he's telling me, punch me in the face, yeah? And he does like a boxer slip and then just hits the opening I've created by my own punch. So by throwing that punch, I've opened up my ribs. That's why kickers beat punchers, is because the leg is longer. But look at him slip it like a boxer and then just go straight after those ribs. This is what I was talking about his right leg coming out to keep his balance. The way he slips, the way you can see his weight shift almost laterally. It's very, very unbalanced. And again, he's telling me, look in the eyes. This is something that I've been working on myself, and I totally understand it. He's making a point that if you don't look in the eyes, you don't see. He's like, you're going to get punched in the eye and not see what's coming. But that's why people look at the hands or the punch. He sees everything by looking in the eyes, like you can see the intention. He's trying to sweep out my front leg as I'm throwing my punches. But because I wasn't off-balanced by it, he just gave up on it. This is beautiful. So this is throwing your strike and landing down and basically just turning it into a step, like a marching step forward. He's like, so you can step outside of your opponent to make them circle around, or instead of stepping out the way he's been teaching me to pivot, you just take an extra step with another strike in order to walk back into your natural stance. He's telling me, he's making a point about how when I throw my left knee, I land down. Throw the right one again so that as I land down again, I'm back in my natural stance. Like you don't take steps back to get back into your stance. You take steps forward with strikes.
Side my God, hang outside. Up, bang, up, boom.
Nice. To see how I needed to land outside his foot, and then he made a point about my foot being closer to his foot so that that elbow would land. These are like minimal changes that have very big effects on your balance and distance against your opponent. If I step too far outside his foot, my elbow misses, even though I threw it really well, even if I'm on balance and everything. But my foot being right next to his versus 3 inches out is whether that elbow lands or not. See how he uses the, like, pushing of my guard for me to feel where that counter comes out of his punches. He's doing, like, a 1-2, and then I feel where my elbow has an opening at the end of that. I was feeling the continuity right there. I gave him an extra knee into the ropes that he hadn't asked for because I was feeling the continuity that he had been asking for before. So he put the pads on, he said, so that I could throw the elbows with power now. The technique should be the same whether there's power or no power. I ended up a little bit stiffer trying to throw power. You can see in the way that he moves his feet and his hips, everything comes from that. So whether you're doing it on pads or not pads with his experience, the power is generated from the same spot, so it doesn't distort the technique at all to then start throwing it with power. So he wants me to be thinking about that left knee as my elbow is coming. And then again, he wants me to pivot outside. Because I'm standing in southpaw and he's standing in orthodox, that pivot is always to his outside, which is really good. His front side, if I'm pivoting outside of it, I'm going into his blind side. If we were both southpaw, or if I was standing orthodox and we were both orthodox, it changed that a little bit in terms of going into someone's blind spot. But pivoting outside is still good because the opponent has to chase you. See how I took that micro step back after that elbow, which meant I had to take another one if I wanted to throw something? That's why you track the foot and just stay on that foot, is there's no reason to take that step backwards. Oh, look at that uppercut. God. His feet almost become squared up when he throws it. Look at that. He said it's the same as throwing a knee, which I thought was interesting, because it means he feels his weight go entirely onto one foot. And my knees have power, so he's like, just do what you're doing for a knee, but with your arm. It's the same technique. Again, that step back, that's totally habitual. And he does not have it. Not one. I'm trying to figure out my feet because I can see that in his combinations, look at his weight transfer and his feet. He steps over for the uppercut and then he just kind of bows his knees for the hook. My weight's going kind of all over the place. His is like completely one piece going from one side to the other. It's very efficient. And because of that, he's always able to throw the next thing. So this left kick and the teeth that he has me do, these are the longest weapons. These are what he uses as the opponent is trying to escape. And he just uses it as the first step in what you could call a stack, or in the way that you're like closing that distance. That's the first one. So the way you come off of it with that guard and the ability to kind of like walk forward with the next strikes, being on balance on that first one is important. Look at my keep watching my right foot because it goes inside his stance quite often, which is why I have to re-correct myself all the time. If my right foot was constantly in front of or slightly outside his front foot, I'd be able to just keep throwing these strikes without any kind of backward step or rocking back or resetting. So he wants me to use that inside leg kick to basically set up for the longer kick. Again, if you watch his front foot, see how his toes are always pointed directly straight forward, and mine are kind of like facing a bunch of different directions at once? Those require micro adjustments because of just where my toes are pointing. So here he's having me do a jab and then the outside kick. He wants me to watch his eyes. And then land with a left cross. He spends some time with me on this, which I really appreciated, which was coming off of that kick. So as you're stepping down off of the kick, you're throwing that cross. I was struggling because I felt like I was snuffing myself. Look where I stepped. Look where I landed. And I'm like, my arm is bent. Like, shouldn't it be extended? And he says it doesn't have to be. He says it's 50-50, like a hook or a cross. It's okay if the elbow is bent, but you want the energy of, as you're coming forward, landing off of that kick. I asked if you hit with the same part of your knuckle because your arm is bent, and he says that you do. It's just those two front knuckles. Look at how much I'm struggling with it. The reason I'm struggling is 100% in my right foot, how it's facing when it comes down. See how he actually lands a little bit outside? His stance becomes a little bit square. See that? And then see the twist on his back foot? He's saying your weight is all coming forward at once. Master K used to say this to me. He's like, you can punch with 100 pounds or you can punch with 10 pounds, and the difference is your full body coming forward or not. So what Ned is teaching me here is to bring your weight and the punch forward at the same time, and the reason I'm struggling is 100% in my right foot. Nen means tight, but it also means accurate. So see how he's imitating me, that I'm winding up on that punch? Look at his weight transfer. See how his right shoulder blew out the line? It went too far to the side? That's the correct one that he just did there. He brings his legs a little bit wide, and the punch flows out of the movement forward and the twist, but he keeps his arm really close to his ribs, like, before it comes out. He felt more power in that, and he was like, how about that? But I could totally still feel that I wasn't landing properly. I couldn't feel that it was my front foot at the time. I'm seeing it now. Like, I'm watching it happen over and over again now. When I see him again, I can fix it. I love that. See how he shoved me back? And I had to, like, land and take a pause before coming back forward. You do that to yourself with your balance if you don't contain your feet.
You can feel his pace, like his rhythm.
I could really feel his pace, like his rhythm, in what we just did, in terms of, like, where he's stepping and where he's landing in order to bring his weight forward. He's in amazing shape, but that was a little bit, he was a little bit out of breath as he was teaching me this. But you can see in what he's teaching, because of this, how the efficiency of staying close and letting the trajectory of coming off of each weapon lead to the next one is an efficacy. It allows you to be this like perpetual motion machine instead of like throwing things. I'm explaining to him that I'm only recently learning how important this eye contact thing is, and it's actually really hard for me. He's like, this is the only way to do it. Like, of course you look in the eyes. He's like, if you look at someone's legs before you kick them and they know that you're going to kick them, they just move out of the way. Always look in the eyes. Look at his energy. So beautiful, because a lot of what he's doing is actually just an approximation of the way he fought when he was 22, but you can still see it. Like, it's still so beautiful. It's the way someone like throws a punch and pulls it, and you can just see the entire thing unfolding. There's just getting slightly out of the way of a teep, just melting away from it, basically. This is why a femur fighter stays close. They're not like running 3 feet back to get out of the way of a teep. They just melt away from it, and that led into him getting into this teep thing. I don't know this technique. The way he does it is so beautiful. He catches it and just gently tosses it to the side, like, I don't need that. Like, he's not throwing it, but it's enough to kind of off-balance the opponent. So in the same way that as your weight is coming down, you're throwing a strike, as their weight is coming down, you're throwing a strike. It's a double impact. He's showing me that there are two ways to catch it. Yodkun Pan does this also. You can catch under, like this, and you can catch over. The important thing to note on this, of whether you're catching over or under, is that the kick is just landing against your bent arm, and you're trapping it with the other hand. So you're not like, you're not avoiding the kick and trying to snatch it out of thin air with one of your hands. It's the way that you like catch a football against your body by like cradling it or something. The kick is coming to your arm and you're pinning it either over or under. Look at the bend in his knees as he does this, though. That allows him to take this slight step to get out of the way of it so that he can clear the leg as he's throwing it. It's just a slide out of the way to take the impact out. Important to note is how his front foot is actually coming closer to me. See how I just went completely sideways? That's making his kick longer, which means it takes longer to reach me, and it takes a little bit of the impact out. The way you truly take impact out is by taking a step slightly closer. By getting closer to the body of the person kicking, you're literally taking the speed and power point out. The closer you are, the safer you are. If someone kicked you with, like, the very inside of their leg, like, up by their thigh, there's no power in it. So you want to get as close to that spot as you can. He's trying to get me to, like, throw his leg away the way that he's throwing mine away. And it reminded me of Diesel Noy, because Diesel Noy is teaching you a technique, but the important part of the technique is kind of the, like, energy or attitude around it. And I had this, like, tense energy of throwing his leg away, that he wanted his very charming, nonchalant, like, I don't need that toss to the side thing. That I didn't... I'm seeing it now, but I didn't quite get it at the time. So I'm catching it, like, hooking under it with my arm and my forearm. And because I'm not taking a slight step out of the way to clear his leg, I can't clear it. So what he's doing here is making me step closer to him, and see how my foot, he wanted my foot pointed towards him so that as my weight shifts over, I'm pivoting a little bit. The reason he's doing this is because the way I was hooking his leg, I couldn't clear it. So what I'm doing here, I don't have to catch it. I can catch it or not.
I want you to catch it, though.
But if I don't catch it, I'm getting out of the way of the power.
Yeah, but you do both.
So he's showing me how getting closer is what evades the kick. He's saying it works with a knee, too. See how he just kind of pivots out of the way. And again, it's making your opponent spin all the time. If they're constantly following you, they're basically like one of those little ballerinas in a music box, like chasing after you, but on a spot, like very close to themselves. They're not chasing after you like in MMA where they're like running around the whole cage. So he's showing me that the lower part of the shin hurts a lot, but higher than that doesn't. So you're trying to get away from the lowest part of the shin, because that's the part that the opponent's trying to put on you. And then because I'm stepping closer to him, I have my counter actually into his open side because of the way I pivoted. And then here, back to these elbows that he was showing me earlier, because of the distance. He's saying if you hit with your forearm, it means you're too close. You want to hit with just the bone because that's what cuts. But he says that the power actually comes from the shoulder. See that little like whip that he's doing with his shoulders, like how boxers pop their shoulders. You don't have to use a lot of strength on elbows. You just want a little like pop across. I like him very much.
Go.
So I have the 123 all-time greatest fighters of Thailand book that I've marked him in so that he could sign it for me. He must have known it existed already because Krongsak, who I visited at this gym before, was so into this book. He must have talked about it with Nate. But what was cool is that even though he's heard about it, he's never seen it. And he immediately, upon seeing these photos, was telling me about each of these fighters. He's fought them. These are Phut Lor Lek, Phut Pat Noi, Wich An Noi. He's talking about how he fought some of the greatest fighters like three times. This is the amazing thing about Thailand, is that if you take fighters from the Golden Age or before, and it's like a fantasy football style, wouldn't it be amazing if these two fighters fought, but you've never seen video of it? You ask them about it, and they fought like three or five times. Like, the rematch and the best of the best fighting each other is part of what made Muay Thai in the Silver and Golden Age what it was, is it was just like dream match.